Conceptual deviants are probably the best two words to describe Paul Laffoley. Laffoley attended Brown University, graduating in 1962 with honors in classics, philosophy, and art history. In 1963, he attended the Harvard Graduate School of Design. He was dismissed for conceptual deviance, showing that the majority of his designs were designated as currently technologically or physically impossible.
Well, they gave me diphthongs for grades. You know, like I'd get A-E's.
Oh, yeah, you either pass
so
or fail.
So I asked them what the hell that meant.
Yeah.
You know, I said, was it A for architecture, E for engineering? He says, no, that we figured that we love your concepts, but they fall down. So they were accusing me of being like Bramante Ruinante, you know, the Renaissance architect that actually had buildings fall down.
Yeah.
And, well, anyway, I, you know, and then they also said things like that I was over-involved in my work. And I said, that's kind of strange, because I thought in a professional school, that's the time to be over-involved. And then they didn't seem to respond to that. So the next question I asked them is there a safe involvement level, like a safe suds level in a washing machine? That didn't help at all. So I knew at that point I was out of there.
I don't think Harvard was ready for your ideas. I mean, you have definitely stepped out into the future. And, I mean, Alex
Gray...
Well,
the first day that... No, not the first day, but the first day we had a socially defined problem. You know, like, how do you create housing that is not costly? Now, that's the same thing that's in the book by Ayn Rand, The Fountainhead,
yeah.
You know, where Howard Roark has to come up with this urban design project that where you could rent a place for $10 a month. Well, this is in the 1940s, so that might have been possible. But anyway... It was a phony problem to them, because they never thought that anybody could actually solve it. And so you'd end up with the same kind of liberal nonsense that we have today. In other words, you have to have something funded by the government, and people would live in there and be financially supported, rather than having a house they could afford. So that's when I started coming up with my idea about how to make live buildings by grafting vegetation together, and just not living in the trees, but making forms that would be connected to each other. So you'd have lighting that would be made by tobacco plants that would be gene spliced with luciferin.
Really?
Which can light up to about 25 watts, Because you can photograph it in the dark. You can photograph the plant, and then with a botanical engineer, you could bring that up to 100 watts, which is the light level that you need. But the whole point was to create a vegetable chimera, which could then go to seed, and then once that happens, you could get the botanical engineer back and said, can you speed up the growth of this so that the whole thing would reproduce itself in 3 months, which is the average time it takes to build a house.
Right.
And so eventually you'd end up giving people a bag of seeds and say, go work in a swamp where the land is practically free.
Go plant your house, huh?
Yeah. And let it grow. And it's the secret is ginkgo biloba, you know, that leaf that everybody takes to help their IQs increase.
Uh-huh.
And but it also has it is the oldest flowering plant on the earth. It was around during the time there were dinosaurs. So that the current plants can be grafted to each other, like conifer to deciduous, you know, like fruits to vegetables, grasses to vines, you know, in that way. It's like, and it, the whole thing would come out very similar to the way we've started to deal with plant nature, like we've made the navel orange.
Uh-huh.
Navel orange didn't exist before we did, and we got it down so that one end of it is where you have the seeds, and then the rest is where you have those nicely shaped sections that fit perfectly in human mouth.
Now, I remember you mentioning in your lecture in Portland how the ginkgo biloba didn't actually follow the phi ratio or the Fibonacci sequence.
No, it doesn't, because the so-called divine proportion, the logarithmic spiral, or the equiangular spiral, is actually the spiral of death, not life.
Hmm.
And people you know, still consider this as something that that should be sought after in architecture. I mean, it's people who are into sacred geometry think that's the source of it, you know, like the Fibonacci series, which is the same thing, and what it really does, it emphasizes the fact that the reason we have that those proportions all through a body is that when we mature, we're ready to die, you know, and so we're starting the dying process, so like a baby is to us all ill proportioned, like the head's big. You know, and the body's soft, and you can flop it around a little bit. Whereas when you reach a certain age, if you fall down, your bones all break. So I've never thought of that as anything but something that's death driven. It's as a spiral, as the logarithmic spiral is the opposite of the Archimedes spiral. The Archimedes spiral starts at a core or an origin, and its radius increases arithmetically. So as you're going around, it's like a coil of rope. So out at the cosmic periphery, it's a complete circle. So the only way to come in to the center then is to make an angle, and so you make an equal angle. You know, and so you're going around. And of course, then the equiangular spiral makes an infinite number of revolutions around the focus, but never arrives, making the source of the origin grow increasing. But it eventually will kill what's coming towards it.
All right. Well, thinking on these lines now, I just went around the nation and filmed a bunch of Kabbalistic architecture that I found in Nashville, Tennessee. And what do you think about these ancient structures like the pyramids, the temple in Luxor, and how they're equated to the golden mean, and how What is it that Kabbalistic architecture is supposed to induce? What should this?
Well, I think when you study the Kabbalah, it's the tree of life, the three pillars and the 10 globes are arranged in a shape that's not dissimilar to a lot of the works of Frank Lloyd Wright. And so I remember, like, in 1981, a guy came into my studio, which at that time was on Bromfield Street, and he said he wanted me to do a farm for him. And I said, how about taking the Kabbalistic tree of life and have incidents at each one of the globes? Because, like, when people study the Kabbalah, I mean, they're thinking more about the paths as opposed to what's inside the globes.
Right.
So I took the general symbolism of each one of the globes and filled that out. Like at Tepereth in the center, I made that big and produced the house of Adam Codman, which is a five-pointed star, and it has in an elevation it has angled surfaces, so if you have glass you can have lights on inside at night, and because of the angle that you can see out, so it's not confining. In the center of it I had this open deck with an open platform to something below, and I figured out how to grow a tree upside down, because that's what is going on. In one way of describing the tree of Sephiroth, it has its roots in heaven and its foliage on earth, and so I took five palm trees and put them in a little more than pots. I had a way to deal with the taproot going down to the ground, and then I bent them over, and then at the lower part I connected a pandanus tree, which is in the same family, and grafted those together, so it had one grouping of foliage aiming down, so somebody could sit on a seat and meditate under this thing, of where you're actually being involved with a live tree that's upside down. Now, I noticed later, like Robert Smithson tried to bury a tree upside down, but that's the thing was dead, someplace in Western Massachusetts, I forgot Mass Mocha, like somebody has some trees upside down, but the thing again they're dead. So I had mine. It was a live tree, which is supposed to be, and then I had things like heliports. I had like beehives. I had all kinds of. I had burrows where you store vegetables underground. You know, so these were again parts of inside of the globes, and then around the whole thing, I had a the labyrinth of Gnosis, where it's not a maze; it goes in one direction. So the whole thing was 1,000 feet long, so it was like a football field.
The whole painting.
And then so when somebody entered the beginning of the labyrinth, say like the postman's bringing something, 9 miles later, he'd come out to a place where he could enter the field. So for the sake of practicality, I built an underground entrance so people could get into it by a car. But from the outside, it looks exactly like the tree of Sephiroth, and I thought at the opening of this, because he wanted to build it in West Virginia, where land is relatively cheap, and so that then at the opening of it, you'd have a holograph of what was there would be lifted off and connected to the end of the physical one, and then there'd be another one, because in the Kabbalah there are 40 worlds, so it isn't just 10. There are four of these shaped forms, and then Darth, which is under Kether at the top, is what connects to the next series of 10.
I see.
Is that making any sense to anybody,
well,
or what?
Well, yeah, what? Because okay, I have looked into the Sephiroth. But I was more curious about, now, I mean, you pop up in the strangest places. I cannot believe that you were an architect on the World Trade Center.
Oh, well, the reason that happened is that I was, because of being thrown out of GSD, Harvard Graduate School of Design, I went to see my uncle, who's an architect, who's now passed on, and the first thing that happened when I walked through the door of his office, he held his hand up. He says, "You can't work here. I heard about you." And I said, I didn't want that. I just wanted, like, some advice. And he says, "Well, what do you expect me to say?" You screwed yourself for the rest of your life. And and then on his desk at that time was a copy of Progressive Architecture, which now no longer exists. It's all been taken over by Architectural Record. And on the cover, there were photographs of work by Frederick J. Kiesler. Now, my eyes popped out of my head. You know, like in Jim Carrey's movie, The Mask.
Right.
You know, he's sitting there, which is actually a reference to some comic strip movies from the 1940s that, you know, the creatures would do that. But anyway, it was a good metaphor, because I'm sitting there and my uncle could see that, and he says, "Well, never work for him." And I said, every time that I talked to this guy, I discovered that he was an absolute source of inverse knowledge. Meaning, no matter what he said, if I did the opposite, I would get into some really interesting stuff. So the next day I was on a train to New York and knocking on Kiesler's door, or actually writing to him a letter, an introduction. I had to write 17 letters before he'd respond to me. I was living at the YMCA for a while there, and eventually he said, "Okay, you can work." And I said, "I sent you the exact same letter. The only difference was that you responded after the 17th time." And he says, "Well, don't you realize why?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" "Well, it's the number 17. And so he said that Borromini, who did the that small chapel in Rome, the St. Carlo of the Four Fountains, San Carlo or Quattro Fontano, had 17 points of perspective. I design furniture that has 17 functions. It's almost like, because it adds the one and the seven adds up to an eight, so that's like a very high powered number." And he said, you lived at 17 Taylor Road in Belmont, Mass." So I at least thought that you would have figured that out. And I said, "My God, the guy was right."
Now, this isn't Yamasaki, right? This is
No. This is Kiesler.
Okay.
Okay.
Kiesler.
So, but then after working for him a few days, he said, "Well, I can't pay you much, so you're going to have to get a day job to live in New York." So I started going around and trying to find places, and I'd go to different offices, and they asked me if I could do working drawings. I'd say, no. Can you do renderings? No. Can you do this, that, the next thing? And I said, no, this I'd be ushered out. I came to the 17th interview, which was for Emery Roth & Sons. Said the whole same routine. I didn't want to lie because they'd catch me in a lie almost immediately. He said, okay, well, put them in the design group. I said, the design group? That's where people end up who have, almost like a PhD in architecture and had years of design could go in there, the ones that are actually designing the building, besides all the flunkies that work in places.
Right.
And so I was walking 2 inches off the ground. And so then a few days later, I discovered why I was in the design group, because it turns out that the Emery Roth & Son is what they call in the trade a pencil, meaning big-time designers come in from other parts of the country, and then when they go to New York, if they don't have a friend's office, they use the Emery Roth as a liaison so that they can do joint ventures and they'll have a place to land and they'll have a plush office with conference rooms and a whole crew of molds over drafting boards are now looking into computers to do their buildings.
Right.
And so I then the deflation started to occur. So I was sitting there for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and I basically wasn't doing anything. So I go up to the guy who was my boss, Mr. Gershon, and I said, Mr. Gershon, I said, why? What am I supposed to do here? He says, nothing's taken place. Or I'm not getting any work. I just come in every day at 9 o'clock, sit there till 5, and that's the end of it. And he said, well, just go back to your drafting board and think great thoughts. Now, I don't know about you, but I never heard anybody say that for real. You know, I thought that was always some kind of movie joke, you know, when somebody would say a thing like that, but I did it. And then another week goes by, and and then I went through the same routine. And what had happened is that before I came there, Yamasaki had done a joint venture with the Emery Roth & Sons on the World Trade Center, and during the initial meeting. They had the design group, the people who were in it before I was there, and he came in, Yamasaki, with his entourage and a big model. And I remember seeing the model; it was a fantastic one. This is when they made models out of plastic, where you would cut the pieces with little tiny saws. And table saws that were miniature, so that you'd build the building, the real thing, but it would only be a miniature. And so he was 5'1", and he had a big pile of papers. So on his tiptoes, he taps the top of this pile, and he says, "Well, boys, fill her up." And so somebody said, "What do you want, high test or regular?" This is the way they defined the difference between grades of gasoline at that time.
Right.
And he went livid. This guy told me he went purple, turned around, and walked out. And they figured they lost the job. And so they were just sitting around waiting for somebody else to come in. So in this second interview, I was sitting there. I said, I can't take this any longer. I got to go someplace where I'm actually doing some work. And so there was a scowl came over his face. And then the secretary stuck her head in the office and says, there's a telephone call for you. And he said, don't bother me. I'm in an interview right now. And he says, she said, I think you better take this one. So he took it. His expression changed. He was like, he almost looked like he was ready to explode. What had happened over the phone is the liaison officer had called up and said that that they wanted in 2 weeks a full design development presentation. They hadn't lost the job. Because Yamasaki's ego was so big, he just wouldn't want to deal with somebody making fun of him. But he was damn sure that this project was going to go through. So I was sent back, and immediately things started to happen. And so I got assigned floors 15 to 45 in Tower 2. It was then that I started to get very confident about what I was doing, you know, because the clients were coming in and they wanted to know what kind of a layout they'd get. And I said, there's going to be trouble because there will have to be 18 elevator banks in three sections to get people to the top. So it's going to occupy a lot of the space that's in the 1 square acre of each floor. And, you know, it was like 212 by 212. And so I kept thinking, these guys want big space that they can do office landscaping, because that was very big in New York. And, you know, meaning so they can move people around and reconfigure the petitions and all that kind of stuff when they want to do focus groups and stuff. They couldn't do it. So they ended up, so I had to sell all these clients a very old-fashioned way of doing boiler rooms. So it stopped being a World Trade Center. So that you couldn't do what say like Gaudi wanted to do in his hotel. He had 5 floors that were completely open, where you could bring goods and services from the 5 continents of the earth, and there'd be stages with orchestras in there and all kinds of stuff. So I started thinking quick. I said, well, how about if you had, if there were bridges across from one of the towers to the other, could you then rent 2 floors across? In other words, all you'd have to do is you could walk on a flat from one part to the other, because now you'd have to go up and down in the elevator, it's pretty small in an elevator, so you couldn't bring your work back and forth with any convenience. And so I started telling people about that. What I had planned, I said that you could have from like the 5th floor up to the top, you could have 17 bridges. I said, that's it. That's the magic number.
Right.
And so they told that the guy that was the head of my department brought that up to the partners, and they thought it was great. So they all called up the liaison officer. He thought it was great. He says, I'll run that by the old man, where he was in Chicago at the time. His normal office was in Seattle, Washington, because he was born on the Pacific Rim. And why he was in Chicago, he was across the street from the building site of the Sears Tower, which would eventually be taller than his.
Right.
And so he wanted to keep an eye on that while trying to fast-track the World Trade Center. So I'm sitting there, working out things where the bridges go, having them built right into the structural center and the thing welded in. And so they told Yamasaki about that, and then he shot back, whatever guy thought of that, fire him right away. Because I want two freestanding towers that are visually vibrating. You know, they're very close together. So what he was doing was producing an 11 in the sky.
Right.
And an 11, which was not the same height. You know, because the two towers were dedicated to David and Nelson Rockefeller.
Right.
And one of the brothers was taller than the other, so they made a 6-foot differential in the towers. Now, so I said I just can't believe what these guys are doing. That it would have been great to have done that. If anything ever happened to that thing, you could have people, you could empty the thing out.
Right.
You know, because if one was on fire, you know, you could bring all the people over to the other one and bring them out. So you'd have 4 or 5 hours extra from anything of that kind. But Yamasaki said, well, that would encourage, you know, people, as human flies going up big buildings. And it didn't stop one guy who worked. He went up the thing and across on a tightrope from one to the other and then down the other side, you know, before the cops caught him.
Yeah. Do you think that he was focusing on this Twin Tower symbolism due to Kabbalism, that perhaps maybe he was looking?
No, this guy, you know, would give lessons to a straight arrow. I mean, he was doing
Yamasaki, we're talking about.
He was into pure exaggerated capitalism.
Oh.
When he worked in Saudi Arabia, and probably a little bit on the beginnings of Dubai, that he wanted to do things like airports, hospitals, hotels, big housing developments over there. And he was the one that got the Ben Laban Construction Company started,
right?
Because that was a construction company that was just limping along, you know, not doing anything. So he trained them in his style. So he came over and had them work on the World Trade Center, because I remember one.
So
one
the Bin
day
Ladens were working on the. Wait. You say the Bin Ladens were working on the trade towers?
Well, not Osama. You know, I mean,
right.
he was one of the trust fund kids,
right,
that came out from this, and that's why his own 50 children have each one has about a million bucks in the bank. You know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But the construction company that Yamasaki used. He had to use, you know, obviously had to use some American ones in there, but these guys were very close, or they were like right-hand men to Yamasaki. And they would go around and to different desks, and one of them came over to me. You know, he was wearing a turban and all this kind of stuff. And you know, and he says, "Where should we put the demolition devices?"
Oh yeah.
And I said, "What the hell are you talking about? Why? This is a piece of paper. There's nothing up there yet." And he said, "Well, we noticed in Las Vegas that people have that stuff, and it's starting to to spread through New York." And I said, what's starting to spread?
Yeah.
Well, to put in demolition devices before before you take occupancy.
No way.
And that means, and the reason for that is what happens in Las Vegas. You know, like if the Bellagio Hotel figures it can make 100 more bucks by moving the hotel 3 feet to the right or the left, they'll tear it down and do it.
Right.
You know, and so this is the same deal, because I remember, you know, like in the 60s and the 70s, if you went to New York on any regular basis, and then you were away for a while, and you come back at the same spot, there'd be a new building.
Right.
And so that it was like Cristo land. You know, they'd have to, they if they're going to demolish it, they'd wrap it, and then they'd get all the dust confined. You know, so it wasn't like what happened, but they'd come down like a set of pancakes.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why you know, World Trade Center building number 7 went down and wasn't hit.
Right.
It's because those things were all connected to each other, so that they could just blow the whole thing up.
Wow. Amazing. Well, okay, 9-1-1 was a very dramatic moment in Americans' lives, and really I feel that we've been pushed to this point where, well, Buckminster Fuller said it best, that we got the challenge of utopia or oblivion. Do you want to get into utopian ideas a little bit?
Yeah.
I'd love to. We've got about 25 minutes left, 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah, I'm taking up too much time here, something on one subject.
It's all good.
Okay.
Fascinating stuff.
The concept of utopia, of course, goes back to Plato, but the person who wrote about it, you know, as an actual fact, was St. Thomas More, mm-hmm. Living between 1478 and 1535, and who wrote a book in Latin in 1516 with the Utopia as the title. Now, what Utopia implies is a new type of space. This space is new in terms of manifestation, but as old as the history of humankind in terms of a quest. It's an ontic state distinct from both heaven or earth. It is a situation that states that which has no history connects to that which has only history. In essence, it is that third alternative to the abstract and the concrete modalities of existence. From an objective standpoint, utopic space appears to have no internal structure, no holiarchies, no hierarchies, no heteroarchies. You know, that's what a holiarchy is, going up and down, or spiritually, hierarchies going up and down politically, and heteroarchies, you know, things off to the side. So you must enter utopic space with one instantaneous immersion, the nature of which is yet to be determined. Now, what that means is that when you're outside of it, it doesn't seem like anything. That's why people have always considered it as just a kind of literary myth. And so once being inside of it, the story is different. The entry evokes a sense of total freedom, complete danger, unimaginable loneliness, and the possibility of imminent death. But within utopic space, there are no external clues as to the actual intensity of its energy. The Wheatstone Bridge, invented in 1872 by Sir Charles Wheatstone, 1802 to 1875, is an electrical thing which can contain greater and greater amounts of electrical energy that cannot be discovered from outside of the bridge, and I consider it the best metaphor for utopic energy. Huh. There exists no external clues as to the actual intensity of the energy of utopic space, or even if the word energy is an appropriate designation at all. The power of the Holy Spirit from Christianity is often associated with the secular concept of energy. Theologically, of course, it is not. Within utopic space, there are no natural directions or dimensions. It is to its inhabitants the environment of transdisciplinary knowledge and the place to experience the authentically new each moment you exist in it. This means, like, you know, when you get an insight, there's always times between that where you don't have any insights. But if you had every moment was a new insight that collapsed one upon the other, you'd get the idea. Utopic space is not the earth limbo of Christianity or hell without punishment. Utopic space is, however, is the proper repository of the goal of all future visions. What we will experience within utopic space is not the end of existence, but the end of the future. So it's something that demands the existence of a working time machine. So that's what I think all the business about 2012 is all about. That
a transformation.
Well, people talk about that as an apocalyptic time, you know, the Mayans and all the rest of it. But I think it's that 2013 is when the first time machine will be available, and from then on, you will no longer have a future, because you can go back and forth. You can have all the time you want to build anything you want. Like I predicted things like structures that are light years in extent that will be necessary for other kinds of activities and getting across the universe and that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's sort of what it is, right?
So that's a moment that takes us out of the third dimension and out of time. All of that no longer exists. Now, what about extraterrestrials?
Well, what about them?
Well, you had said that it was obvious to most everyone that today that the universe beyond our immediate locale will be as important to our personal futures as it will be to the collective future of the human species.
Oh, yeah.
Because
we will need to interact with them. I mean, I've had ideas years ago about how to start dealing with the solar system. You know, where I've hooked the Earth up to the moon, and I remember in 1980 talking to Buckminster Fuller in Florence at a World Future Society meeting about that, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning in a hotel. He couldn't sleep for one reason or another, and I couldn't, so I just started talking to him. And I said, the thing that I'd been thinking of is taking the geodesic sphere and double layering it around the Earth off about 12 miles, and then doing the same thing to the moon, but then have a physical link between them, which could be accomplished by Kenneth Snelson's discontinuous compression structure, which works best as like a tower. It's a structure that has no deflection. You know, like when you build something on the Earth that's subject to gravity, that people use wood or steel, but still any of those things are going to deflect and bend. Mm-hmm. This thing doesn't, because the compression elements and the tension elements are separated and only connected at one point or several points, so that they're strategically designed so that you could send them out into space great distances. And of course, between the Earth and the Moon, there are things called Lagrange points, which are zero gravity positions. And that's due to Bode's law, you know, of why the planets line up the way they are and why they stay apart. The thousands of miles from each other that they do. Right. And so that you could go to those parts and start building towers and then have them connected. And then, of course, they'd have to be expansion joints, because the moon comes closer. And then on the moon, you'd probably have to add rocket power to offset the drag of what was going on. But what would happen is that As one shell rotated over the other, you would have a spherical electric waterfall, which means that then you could send electricity down to the ground anywhere you wanted. And you would be able to do things like clean the environment. I mean, we've sent up in the sky at the highest stratosphere, which is about 12 miles, you know, a lot of vaporized elements, and we need to get that stuff back down onto the Earth, because like about every 10 years, Landsat does photographs of the Earth, and all the deserts grow bigger. You know, we're having problems with trying to keep vegetation going. So that's why I think there's another reason that we should start connecting vegetation together, right, so that we can restore its original mission, which was to keep life going, because without vegetation we'd simply die.
Absolutely.
But we have to do it in a way that offsets the Industrial Revolution. I mean, the Industrial
right.
Revolution is now a few years older than 150. It's probably like 157 years old. And within that short period of time, humans have essentially raped the Earth.
Exactly.
And so when you're coming around to offset anything like that, you have to do something that's as dramatically different, but of the same power level to be able to make that work. So I thought this is probably the only plan. So I remember as a 10-year-old kid being taken down to the Goethe Institute, because I used to take some courses at Rudolf Steiner's Waldorf schools, because I used to live in Belmont. There was one there. And so I'd go a few times, and they started talking about their Urpflanze, the primordial plant concept that Goethe developed,
yeah,
which was before Darwin. And so somebody talking about it said, well, of course, this was only a fanciful notion that he had. But I said, well, what would happen if you connected all the vegetation around the Earth together? Wouldn't you then have the one plant from which all other plant forms are derived? You know, and there was no answer to that.
No.
But that was my immediate reaction, and I carried that through all my life, and I really think that's the way to go. Because if people, like in science fiction movies, talk about terraforming the Earth, they don't mean going to Mars and living in tin cans, you know, connected with tubes, you know, to each other a little ways. That's horrible.
Sounds miserable.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Gerard O'Neill's, you know, having rotating tin cans in space and
yeah,
stuff like that. I mean, that's really not a way to think about how to get to other stars. You got to start mega engineering solar systems from planetary systems from different stars, and start thinking in bridges that are light years in extent. Excuse me, I guess. Jeez. Oh my God, I'm getting a cold. Okay,
sorry. You now have 800 paintings somewhere around that, right? And all of these different concepts.
Yeah.
Not to interrupt you, but we're running low on time. I was curious about the CAT scan, the implant, and what you thought about
said
that.
Well, one time, this is in like 1992, my teeth started falling out. And so people said, well, you know, don't get regular false teeth, because they now have a new thing. You know, they call them implants. You know, they just drill into your jaw, and then you can stick in a tooth, and it looks just like a real tooth and works that way. So I went to the Beth Israel Dental Clinic, and then had some oral surgeon look me over, and he says, well, you're get a pretty good candidate. You got a lot of mandible jaw there, and your bones are really good. So, but I'm going to have to I'm not going to rely on those little tiny X-rays they normally give people, and so you're going to have a CAT scan of your head. And I didn't know what that was, and I getting set up for that. I thought I was going through the hair dryer from hell.
Yeah, right.
You know, when you put through. And I was in there about an hour and a half. And I kept asking the guy, when is this over? And he says, well, we've got some problems. And I said, like what? Have you ever had your neck broken? And I said, no. I said, at that time, I'd only had a collarbone broken when I was 7. And he said, well, yeah, maybe it's not your neck. He says, but have you ever been shot? And I said, why are you asking me these questions? Because there's something in your brain. And I said, what's in there? And so he checked. He kept making more and more pictures of you know, my brain on my head from different directions, and then said, "There's something in your between your two in the back of your occipital lobes, you know, back where there's where you see things, you know, come from there." That I said, well, "What's there?" He said, "It's something." About 3/8 of an inch long, a 1/16 of an inch in diameter, and rounded at both ends. And I said, "What's its orientation?" He says, "Well, if you were standing up, it would be vertically oriented, in line with your spine." And I said, "That doesn't sound like any bullet that I've ever heard of." Yeah. And he started to agree with me, and he said, I can take you directly to an operatory right now. I'll pull the thing out. And I said, wait a minute. You're going to take one of those round saws and then take a plug out of my skull and start fiddling with my brain? I don't think so.
No.
And so he then said, well, I'm going to take these pictures and bring them to a chapter of MUFON, which is in Medford, Massachusetts. And I said, do you deal with flying saucers and stuff? He says, yeah, I happen to be that way.
Yeah.
And so the person who they brought me along after an initial meeting with a physicist from Tufts University who was in the group also, and he said that what he figured that I had in there, because I made no. I never worried about it. It never gave me any pain or anything like this. That this was a bio nanotechnological device, because any civilization just even only 1,000 years older than we are would have commercialized nanotechnology and then fused it with biology.
Do you think you were abducted?
I have no recollection of that or anything.
All right.
I've never had any, you know, dreams waking up and, you know, it's not, this is not like Whitley Schreiber, you know, in Communion and that
right.
kind of stuff. No, I just had no thought about it at all.
Uh-huh.
But what this guy was telling me kind of made some sense, because, as a way of dealing with the civilizations light years away from you, it wouldn't be profitable to go there. What would be better is to buckshot a parsec of space with these devices that would then hit sentient beings and not hurt them, but enter things like pores and then go into the bloodstream and go to things like the ventricles in the brain. And I noticed in studying this stuff myself later that there is a ventricle in the brain that's right where they were talking about, that where something could fit. So it would be like this ultra-small thing would, you know, just landed on me and didn't hurt any tissue, but made the journey to where it should be and set up shop and then took all the time. We're coming apart with atoms all the time, so these things could be useful to a nanobot, you know, in building this whole thing. So it would not be a thing like bird banding. Okay, for a speck of light that's billions of light years away. Who the hell cares where you go? You're trapped on a planet. So what they'd really want to know is whether we are ahead of them technologically, be are they behind them? Whether we'd be good to eat, you know, would be a good place to settle, you know, all the kinds of stuff that you've seen on Outer Limits.
You think they're sitting back there watching some Laugh-A-Lee TV?
Yeah, something like that. But it really started to make sense to me because all the people that have had trouble, you know, all the things that John Mack talked about, is that they were discovered in odd places in a person's body, like behind the knee, you know, stuck in the up their nose, and this, you know, things where that it would seem to me that what happened is that they entered the body and then never made it to the proper site and then
right.
set up shop and then caused the creature pain. But what the hell do they care? You know,
do you think that these conceptual ideas, we've got just 2 minutes left. Do you think that these conceptual ideas, I mean, you've designed machines that involve 1,000-foot jellyfish and such.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, about that, is it because I kind of agree with what you're saying now, because when I was born, I have Asperger's syndrome, which was occurred later. But when I was 4 years old, my mother took me to Harvard again for the first time, and they said my IQ was 79. And then later on, with the help of somebody that taught at the Waldorf School, my IQ went up to 189. Now, I don't think that variation in an IQ is possible.
Right.
So what I believe now is what you're saying, is that I was given a set of ideas.
Yeah.
And for testing. It's like what they wanted to do is test the world view of wherever they were sending these nanobots, or whatever you want to call them. Probably that's obsolete now.
Well, I'll tell you what, this Earth is still considering you conceptually deviant. They're not quite ready for the ideas that you have. I think that you're about 200 years in the future, but hopefully not, because I'm hoping your ideas come to fruition. I'm ready to grow my house and bring about utopic space.
Yeah, because I think you'll like it.
I think I would like it, too.
Okay.
Well, Paul, it has been wonderful talking with you. You're going to be on again Thanksgiving, so there's a good note.
Oh, yeah, well, you told me that.
Yeah,
that's
the
right.
talk that we had. And
great.
Next week,
yeah.
We'll be talking with Janet Swerdlow on mind pattern programming and the use of sex. It should be interesting. Paul, you are one of the most wondrous people I've ever discussed anything with. I hope we get to talk some more. Never is an hour long enough to get into anything this diverse.
Okay, well, Freeman, thanks for inviting me.
Hey, no problem. Right. I'll hope to talk to you again, because as we start to look at these ideas, and if you look into Paul Affley's ideas, which you can find on freemantv.com, you go there and link to Paul Affley's archives, you will find all of his artworks, his ideas, these massive engineering plans, the ideas of constructing your house by growing them, genetically modified homes that grow themselves in 3 months. The ideas of utopia are not lost on Paul, and he is a fantastic person to know and to experience his thoughts and understanding. So please check him out.